discovered how fortunate they were, how blissful they were before they got wise. So don't envy any wise man because he's wiser than right. Be happy that the ignorance that you seem to model through, and don't get trapped in the word ignorance. It simply means ignore. It don't mean anything more than that. It doesn't mean a lack of knowledge or uneducated. It's the fact that you ignore the functioning of the relationship between a spoken word and the commitment to an action. Until you're conscious of the realization of the two, you are in a state of complete protection from your motive. So be happy that your mouth don't blow you away before your time. Because it would be very, very traumatic or tragic that you integrate right away with the sonics and the atom and you're the end product, you know what happened. You blow yourself away. So for that reason, the masters and all these realized men that come to encourage us. They know the truth, but they want us to make our own encounter, our own personal experience. Was asking the mantra, and I think the question is this young man was wanted to ask you. You want to repeat your question about?
I was wondering how long you would have to repeat the name over and over in order to notice some good in fact mark out the name.
As long as you can breathe.
I wasn't talking about that beginning at all, just in terms of how much time you get to make something good.
Well, let me put it this way. Years ago, I wrote a man, his name was Yogananda. I wanted to buy 100 books from God. Because I thought in books I find all the knowledge about God. And he wrote me back a letter and said, what is all the knowledge in all the books in comparison to 15 minutes silence in the soul? It took me 18 years to discover 15 minutes silence in the soul. So it was quite a long time before I even experienced what 15 minutes silence in the soul was. And it happened one day, I was called on the phone while I was living in Dallas by a friend of mine who was an airline pilot, and he said, I'm flying down to Mexico to bring a plane back for the company, and the company's going to go on strike. If you can meet me at the airport mezzanine with your friends in a few hours, I'll be back with this person on a plane who's an Indian teacher. And the plane is rerouted from its original destination in Austin, flying from Mexico, but it's flying through to Dallas and route to Washington, D.C. And they don't know about it, and this is strictly came up like that because the company is going to go on strike. But I am commissioned to go pick up this person and fly now with an empty plane to go get it. Hours after, this plane came back to Dallas. We met the gentleman and his associates. They came out, they only had 45 minutes to stay for refueling, and they're en route to Washington, D.C. We had the little room assigned to us, and we had some food spread out on the table. He walked up and he looked around and he said, you must think I'm really hungry or starving. It was all that food. And he said, we'd like you to enjoy our hospitality. So he sat down,
looked around in the room and kept looking at everybody. No one had asked any questions. And then at the end of the first 15 minutes, I checked it. And he looked straight at me and he said, "Are you getting the books?" Well, right there and then, something clicked in my body, and I can feel this particular flow of energy. And then looked around again. Any questions? Nobody asked any questions for a while. And he kept on looking, enjoying his every faces. And the next 15 minutes, right on the clock, he looked exactly to me and said, "Are you getting the books?" By that time, several people were starting to grumble. "What books is he talking about? We getting all kind of books here." I'd say, in my head, I know what he's talking about, because he's lambasting me with the letter that I wrote Yogananda years ago, and here's 18 years after the incident, and we were facing each other across the room. 15 minutes, that's the second 15 minutes. And then someone says, "Sir, are you going to initiate anybody in this present trip to America?" And he looked around and said, "I didn't make any reservations for that. But I am lecturing in Washington, D.C., end of the statement. The person who asked the question never left or did anything with that statement. Two other friends of mine, when they heard that statement, they took off immediately when the teacher got in the plane and left and headed to Washington, D.C. and got initiated in private by him. And that was the interesting phenomenon. When they arrived in Washington, D.C., they told me after what happened that no one knew of them initiating except two other persons like himself. So there are four people allowed to be with him in private to get an initiation. All the rest that were there hearing that was just a problem. But the next 15 minutes, this is 30 minutes ago, when they asked this question about it. He looked around, he said, "Any more questions about it?" Then exactly the last 15 minutes, take 45 minutes, he looked at me again, he said, "Are you getting the books?" By that time, everybody thought that that is cuckoo to do it. I was zapped with the energy, and I know what he's doing already. And then he looked at what and said, "I guess my plane is ready, I should be leaving." And he got up and his associate, and we started walking him to the plane. So the whole group began to sing a song for him. And the song was, "Listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget you, I will never forsake you." And he turned and he looked when he was singing it. And teardrops started to form around his eyes. And his associate, the doctor, said to him, "Don't let him cry in the public. Please. He loved the devotion." And I waited to the folks to ease down on the love and devotion. And he did that. And he went aboard his plane. The point is this. The 15 minutes, three times in 45 minutes, indicate a sort of polarity principle. And the answering of my request of books from Yogananda years ago was the completion of the experience. Yogananda couldn't give me the 15 minutes in my soul, but he indicated where God is. So it wasn't in books. So 18 years passed, and here is sitting a man totally God realized, and he's looking at me and making the comment after 15 minutes. But when he made the comment, I felt like somebody pressed a switch in the back of my head and my whole brain went zzz, like an elevator. It went from the beta level right down to the delta level, and it stayed there for 15 minutes. Well, the next 15 minutes comes up, and he says, "Are you getting the books?" To feel the breakers. The statement is the words, "Are you getting the books?" I wanted 100 books on God. You see, I'm living with sonics now, you see. I get the actual exchange of the principle, and then the last 15 minutes is right there. And I realize that these men who actually lived the experience and identify the spoken word satisfies every need in strange, simple ways. And the comments that they make, if you don't know how to read it, you miss it. The one person who has to be initiated, or final teacher initiated, his answer didn't say yes or no. He merely said, "I didn't make any arrangements for it. I'm lecturing in Washington, D.C. He didn't say come. And he didn't say I'm initiating. But he gave, in the simple statement, his commitment, if they would go. Now, that person who asked did not go. Two who didn't ask, as soon as they heard it, they took off. They went, and when they arrived in Washington, and the experience that they had to go through, they found that there were only two other like themselves who came from another location to that same area to be there, and only four of them were initiated. And there were over 300 people present in Washington, D.C., that never asked to be initiated by him. And yet, four people, two from Texas, two from another location, were in Washington, D.C. for it. Now, over the years went by, a friend of mine was gathering up documentation on the visit of this particular teacher and wanted to know where all the places he went and stayed. And so they have the documentation, a total book of it. And only 45 minutes that is not documented is where he was in Dallas. Somebody said, "Why did you not turn in the documentation?" I said, "No, that's my personal prize and gift to me from my teacher, Yogananda. Because I don't want to feel that I have to share that." And he told me, "What is all the knowledge and all the books in compartment 15 minutes silence in the soul?" And here this teacher shows up and zaps me 3 times 15. I think that's fine. I deserve to keep that as a private gift. So, but what it really taught me, or helped me to experience, is the principle of the spoken word, the repetition, and the involvement that goes with it. You may start out repeating a mantra and think you're not getting anywhere with it. And you may think that you have to put in a lot of repetition in order to get some result from it. And you may think that you're fooling yourself to be involved in such a process when more important things come up to take your interest. Let me assure you, the result is not where you think it is, or how you get the result. When you start off repeating something, there are thousands of people who are operating at a delta level, and one of them will come into your life. And that one is going to make the particular repetition click for you at the right time. And you may think you're doing it and you don't think you want to do it. And you may think it's never going to be possible. But you see, you can't start a process like sonics involving the atoms and live if unfinished. Because those who have realized it are immediately magnetically drawn there. in some strange way, either by crossing your path in a store, attending some strange meeting on a strange page. They'll cross your path and they'll give you a little sound, just enough to let you know you aren't alone in this universe. You see, this man lived in India, and Yogananda lived in California, and I was living in Canada. And I knew of the man, but I never knew he'd come to America. But I knew of Yogananda, so I was communicating with Yogananda. When Yogananda passed away, I said, well, I missed the boat. But Yogananda gave me enough permissions to know that I didn't miss the boat. And it was 18 years after when I encountered the other man. And every 15 minutes, he called him. So I said to myself in the end, how can you really think you're left out? The whole process is timing and patience. Once you decide to do it, allow this creative intelligence to have many ways to fulfill it. And it's not your so-called dedication that fulfills it. It is your willingness to stick it out. Then all the other things begin to pull, because nature abhors a vacuum. She doesn't like no human being sitting down repeating the name all day. She'll sooner or later quiet them. pour a bucket of miracles on top of his head. Just to make him satisfied that he is in tune with the truth. It's one of the funniest things. I don't know if you ever heard of a person called Sai Bhanu, but he does exist. And normally, he's an expert in manifesting a substance called Vibhuti, or holy ash. Well, the holy ash had been analyzed and it contains all 144 elements. Question, it is not that it contains all these elements, but what is funny is about this. I have seen pictures and I've known people who have stood in front of him when he was manifesting the ash, and the quantity that he would manifest versus the container it came from, if it was a sleight of hand, he'd have to walk with a 50-pound bag on his back to do it. The container was this small, and the end product was this high on the ground, and it would need a 50-pound sack to pour it through. So we know there's no sleight of hand going on in the process. They had one scientist who went to study him, and this was a remark the scientist made. Before I could get the question out of my mouth, Bob was answering it. So that blew his mind then. Before he could actually get the sonics out of his mouth to ask the question, Baba was already answering the question. And what they're trying to show us is that the link between man and the Creator is the voice, and the lining up of the atoms in your own body with the elements. And the only thing that interferes with the alignment is your resistance. Now, we use the word ego, and we may feel threatened by it because we're so programmed to hear it as something being detrimental to us. To the realized person, ego simply means energy going. To the non-realized person, it means all kind of labels or misconceptions as to what it's not doing. But anyone who is realized knows that ego simply means energy going. Now, it doesn't say where it's going, but it's going. I give an example. If I unplug this cord, one of these units is going to stop running, right? But if somebody pulled the switch outside, the whole room is going to go out. And if they don't pay the electric bill, they don't pay it. So that's what we call ego. Energy going, but at different levels of the little switch, plug, and everything. If you don't breathe, you would be listening to me and I would be talking to you if I don't breathe. Now you know where ego is? Ego is when they cut the cord and you take the breath, and if you synchronize with it, they keep you. If they don't synchronize, they'll get a mechanical gadget to guarantee it. And if the mechanical gadget doesn't guarantee it, then they'll take what they call a fetus, they can call it a human being, and bury it. So then, where is ego now? Ego is actually your ability as a physical form to synchronize with the respiratory function after the cord is cut. So you're entitled to your ego. Don't throw it away. Because without it, you're going no place. You see, it's the ongoing energy in you. But the fixation or the attachment to the various functions that you think you have to be involved in makes that sensation very, very traumatic. But if you don't relate to it that way, ego is a very wonderful friend because it allows you to live the now. Now, then you will discover in the now three things about yourself. One, that's be. That's wonderful about yourself, to be, and to be here right now. So you can't be no place else because no other place else exists than here. And here is now. So as a being, you are here now and being here right now. And that's what is be. So they said to be or not to be is the question. Well, it's not so much the question, it's the quest of the ion. The real be is the ion right there, actual existence. That's what the yogi calls sat, or existence, be. Now it's non-geometrical. Right away you know that you can't place no boundary lines on be. Be provides an unusual quality to your mechanism called I. And out of this I, total freedom is endowed in it. It's called individuality. And B cannot take away it from I. It is endowed I with total freedom and individuality and can't take it back. It only can make it account for goofing up by presenting it with the bill called me. That bill called me, and more of me is memory. So the game goes on between I and me, called memory, in an organism called me. B stores I, gives it freedom, and reminds it of its mucking up with the bill called me, or memory. And what is interesting about the three of them in one, you see that's the combinated polarity, trinity, they all come back to act as one. Now, me is a beam. You are this creative principle. It's so simple and yet so hard to experience. It's being,
total existence, no geometry, can get rid of it. That means it's immortal already. So the feeling of immortalness and infiniteness, eternalness, is already there aggravating you. Then at the same time, you feel limited and stupid with the fact that you have an eye, and it's so free, it doesn't know what to do with itself. And it's constantly being reminded that it has to shape up through the me called the memory. And it goes back and forth playing this game with itself. And it uses the most unique method to play the game. And that unique method is voice, spoken word. Now, I, does that have geometry? Does B have geometry? Does me have geometry? In this non-geometric unity, the game for geometry, alphabet, and numeral is going on with the mouth. Passively trying to integrate it. So, if you say you're mentally ill, it's only because you have localized geometry on one of those words. If you try to put geometry on I, you'll get sick. If you try to put geometry on me, you'll get sick. If you try to put geometry on B, you'll get sick. You never resolve the anguish. But take away the geometry, take away the alphabet of labeling it, and take away the numbering of it, and feel, you'll notice you're right here now. And you haven't gone any place. And the only problem you'll have to overcome is unconsciousness. There is nothing in this world to overcome. So to him that or her who overcomes, I will not send forth a second time, but I'll make him or her a pillar in the house of the creation of Lord itself. When you overcome through the use of the me and the I, the unconsciousness of sleep, you're awake in the be. And that is why we say be here now. There is no place to go. You're eternal, you're immortal. But the reward of this is the non-decomposing organism as a evidence of the accomplishment. And the other benefits of beam in, beam out, visible as visible, no boundary lines, see? So, when you're visible, they say you're alive. When you're invisible, they say you're dead. Are you really dead? It's just that you're invisible to some people. And to others, you're totally invisible all the time. Because the unity of I, me, and B is unified. You can't hide no more. But there is no need to hide in the first place when you're unified. Because the knowledge that flows through you, you didn't make it. And it's not in a book either. You can read all the books of God and never find God. But in the mechanism, the integration of the voice and the atom occurs. Now, many of us get carried away with the craving to perform the miracle.
And Paul will tell you, when he was in the body, I rebuke you in your rejoicing, for I live and die daily in the Lord. Those people who were craving to perform miracles, which he called the gift of the Spirit, warranting it or earning it, was called the gifts. Somebody gives you a gift, you didn't earn it. You didn't buy it. They're giving it to you out of a function. But it's different than a plant bearing a fruit. It earned it. It grew it. So the fruit of the Spirit is the actual realization of the commitment of the spoken word to an action of experience, that you must live it, act what you say. That's the spoken word, that's the actual experience, that's the real fruit of you. Paul is the fact that you become conscious and unconscious, and you do lock into the I, the me, and the be, through the spoken word, or what you say to yourself before you go to sleep, is the actual essence of your true nature. So when you go to bed, don't go to bed with the idea you're going to wake up to go to work tomorrow. Go to bed with the idea you want to be totally realized now. So you don't have to wake up no more. Or go to sleep no more. You see? Because if you say, I want to realize myself right now, the emphasis on it opens the consciousness. Now, your repetition of a mantra comes in three states. Orally, like you heard my voice just now. Mentally, with my mind repeating it. Or inhaling it. Your nostrils are making a sound, and you may not even know it that it's making a sound, but blow the air out with your nostrils and see what it's doing. Right? It's making a sound. Don't try and put a language structure around it. Because if you do, then you're putting geometry or alphabet around it. But if you listen to that sound, eventually, you'll notice the strange phenomena occurring in the atomic structure of your body. And that is how they began teaching men to work with mantra or repetition of words, to work its way back from the oral level or sonic level to the or audible level, right through to the mental intonation level, and finally through the biological resonance of breathing and respirating, in and out, contracting and dilating, to identify with the signs. The intensity of this identification allows you now to say something, and then it begins to materialize. Those who have gone through it all can say this much. A minimum of 12 to 18 years is the required time for the body to achieve this particular phenomenon. It doesn't come any earlier. But the wise men can point three periods in your life where this phenomenon begins to show up. Between age 30 to 35, between 45 to 65, and finally between 85 to 95, the phenomena of the spoken word predominating everything in your life begins to manifest. And so realized men come in with different purposes at different times to perform different work. And the one work they're doing is only to remind their fellow brothers and sisters to take more interest in the spoken word. Modern science is making it obvious as we understand it more and more and we make more mechanical gadgets to use it. But
explore thing or whatever it is, the basis behind it. Any other questions?
Now, what about speaking a little bit about
detachment? The Greeks had two words for love. The first word was agape. And agape is something like this. And the second word is eros. And you're eroding. So when you get attached to the erosion, you break down. And out of that came the word erotic. It's the attachment to the contact with. So in eros, we say to the next person, I'm in love with you. Automatically, you program the opposite by saying, I am in. What would be the opposite now?
Out.
Because nature abhors a what? A vacuum. She doesn't want you to go fly that way. That's why the Chinese people say the whole world is yin yang. There's no that or that. It's interaction upon itself. So we don't have another that gave the left brain right brain interaction. The attachment is the fixation. Now it's in the fixation and the attachment that the Buddhist teachings came up with the idea that suffering is in the attachment, not in the desire. But they didn't know how to say desire and explain it as a principle, so they said the word desireless. To be desireless is to be detached, and that's the pure love. That's how they explain it. But when you really understand the word desire, it comes from the word sire, to rule, and D is dual, and to reproduce. So anyone who has a desire, they have a feeling or a craving to do two things. To build a certain structure and then to involve in a certain repetition. But the fixation of the repetition and the attachment to the repetition is where the agony is in the process. So if you can disengage from the fixation and the agony and relate in a flexible state, then desire is a rational function because God himself desires to create, but he is not attached. That's why he took off on the sixth day. You see, now if she was totally attached, you wouldn't take off with no day. But this is to say that in the body, we have what is called rest periods. And attachment is a function that creates the anguish in love. But then, nature, knowing that this would be detrimental to the mechanism, provided a phase dump or a safety valve on consciousness, sleep. This safety valve was to preserve the mechanism from eroding away through the attachment. Now, you may love someone and you're attached to them. And when you fall asleep at night, how much attachment have you got? You see, nature is trying to show you that you can't really be attached to anything external. You can only be attached to the internal structure of you, a sperm and ovum put together within a matrix. That's why we finally end up loving people, and then we have to let them be what they are. You can't take away their individuality from them. And the more we love them with this freedom to be themselves, sooner or later our own true nature flows out. The compassionate nature, the compassionate love emerges. Otherwise, possessive love will erode. Possessive love will create anguish and violence. But the compassionate love forgives. But that's hard to do, because if somebody aggravates you, hurts you, you will want to forgive right away. You see, it's not so easy to turn the cheek. It's quicker to hit him back. That's natural. It's difficult to do the other, hit you and then turn. But I was fortunate to see where that principle worked. Normally I grew up in a martial art family where you hit and you hit back. And this is the mosaic law, a knife for a knife, a tooth for a tooth. And though I grew up as a Christian, Catholic, studied a brief priest, left and I went to study engineering. I have never seen the principle of turn the cheek. And Jesus said this, if you're somebody hit you, turn the cheek. This was one day I was in Canada, and I was going into an elevator. And there was a tall Frenchman who was drunk, and with a short Englishman that came in, and I was a third person. And the drunken man was didn't know what he said. You doggone Limeys, you walk, whap. And he hit the guy one blow in the jaw. And I said, hey, wait a minute, you got this guy doing that. And he held me back and said, don't worry, man. So I thought it ended. He turned the jaw like that to the guy. And the guy is still drunk, and he went on again, you doggone Limeys, wham. And the second jaw. By that time, I was ready to throw the guy out of the elevator, bigger than this. He shouldn't do that. The guy called me back. And he turned again the jaw the third time. And the Frenchman lifted up hand to hit that guy. And to this day, the hand never came down. He was like that. He didn't touch him, because if he touched me, I wanted to learn the technique. What was the martial technique that he touched his guy and he would stay like that? The elevator stopped, I came out, and the English fellow held the Frenchman by the hand, brought him out, left him there at the edge of the elevator, started like that, and he's going down the road. I know this man has been hit very hard. And I ran up and said, come on, man, I want to know what you. And he looked at me and says, I learned this from your people. My people? No, man, you don't have to be near that. He said, well, I was in verbal. I was hurt and given up to die. And some monks found me. And they rescued me, and I grew up in their place, and they fed me, and I got well. And it's in their temple I learned this technique. I said, what technique? He said, turning the cheek. He said, I learned martial art there. They taught me. And then when you're ready to leave, one of the monks would come up. Big, huge one. He says, are you ready to take a test? And so, you know, what was the test? He said, well, you have to stay up like that. And he would whack you one. And you have to turn his cheek again. And he'd whack you a second time. And turn his cheek the third time. And I said, well, come on, man. You have to hit that man somewhere. You have to do something. You have to. He said, no. If you stood the second blow, weren't destroyed. He says he had to go through, because he saw it happen many times at those who passed the test. All he had to keep in his mind, turn the cheek. And he said the third time the monk tried to strike, the hand was still like that and lock itself and go down. He knew that he had mastered the art. And then the monk would hug him and he said, oh, you can go back anywhere. And he got his health back, he left and came back to England. But then from England he came to live in Canada. But then I met him, that was the first time I've ever seen anybody apply at the martial art level this particular principle. Because I know when you, in the art, somebody hit you, you hit back. And we grew up with the idea that if they hit you and you get up, make sure when you hit them, they don't get up. That's how we were trained. But that is, again, the sonics and the spoken word. Turn the cheek. third energy. The mind can say the mantra, the mouth can say the mantra, and the body can say it. And the three of one. And that's the same with the love. The attachment and the loving person from the compassion nature. You have to go into the compassion. So the more compassionate you are, you know that that person has endured a lot of pain. Because I don't know of any person gaining compassion without pain. Take a child, all right. You have your most beautiful china, and he reached up to pick something out to be able to knock down your beautiful china. It cost you a fortune in the first place. Maybe it will smash it head in the pieces. You're going to be angry because the beautiful thing will be broken. But then, if it's your first experience as a mother and a child, the portion of you starts to expand. That's the compassionate nature. And so the compassionate nature overrides the attachment. The compassionate nature allows you to flow. And so we have both conditions, the agape and the eros in ourselves. We got both. We have to bring the compassionate now to override the erotic or eroding process of the love, or the in and out movement of love. And if we can do that, we are free. But again, it's not an overnight process. I couldn't tell you it's an overnight. I don't know of anyone overnight arriving at this state of being detached and loving. It's a lot of pain and anguish involved. But if you can stick it out and don't panic, the love will demonstrate. I think the hardest thing in love between two individuals is the not knowing how they will react, and we panic before we find out how they will react. And that panic puts us into an abrasive level, or abusive level, or a violent level. But if we don't panic, and we can just coax along or post along with the situation, in a strange way, it starts to phase down. But panic seems to be one condition that aggravates destruction. But you have this consolation in love. Jesus never said that we could love without attachment. He merely said, love the Lord thy God with all of your mind. Now, all of your mind, you don't have time for the other person. So you got all that already inclusive for you. And with all of your heart, so very little of it is going to drift away to outside. Of course, it's got to be focused on the inside. And with all of your strength, that's the respiration, because you don't have strength for life without breathing. And with all of your soul, that you don't have the sense of identity without being alive. So this love is first. This is why they call that the agape. You're involved in the unification of yourself. It's the next sentence that is very, very challenging. And your neighbor as yourself. And they say, like yourself. You can't really love nobody like yourself. But you can love another person as yourself, because they're involved in the same process of finding their own identity. And then you have to allow them to be. And when you have the understanding of how you put together, you can see why they are what they are and what is holding them from expressing. Because they are born within a certain time frame, they have certain emotional feelings, and they have to live it out. And that's what they call the horoscope. They call it the scope of the horror. Because each person has one moment in which they come in with a lot of anguish. But that is the person they have to work it through. You come in at a certain time, you have to work it through. The three wise men went looking for Jesus, and they found him at a certain time. So they knew that the scope is involved with each person. You can't shift out. So we can only truly love ourselves. It's not selfish in the first place. It's the understanding of how we put together. Then when we understand that, we can love the next person as ourselves, like a reflection. And the compassionate nature emerges more to work with that person. And that's why if tell us that we have to learn timing. The man Solomon put that very clearly when he was alive, that there's a time, a place, and a season for everything. Time is your health. Place is your pocketbook. And season is the relationship. If the person is hot or cold, you gotta warm them up or cool them down. So how you relate to a person is the temperature reaction. Where you want to make your fortune, that's the location. So they say, go west, young man. Or go east. But find a location where it's practical for your pocketbook. You can be in the wrong place and starve, you know? Or be in the right place and not starve. So that's the basic law of supply and demand. Timing is your health itself. In the wrong place, at the wrong time, you get sick or get an injury. So that's what you have to watch. So when it comes to attachment in love, love overrides, but then each one of it has a specific function. To relate to another human being, you're going to meet many people. Not all can relate. And that is why all teachers or people who realize will tell you this. We love the world, but we can't be involved with the whole world. Those who respond or synchronize are the ones who will relate to us. And those who don't respond and synchronize are not ready. You can't go push them. So when you live with a friend or relate to somebody and there is no connectedness, you have to let them be, or you'll be fooling yourself. It's an understanding that you have to come with and not to be free. See, the thing is this, ancient people used to study the horoscope of relationships so that when people got together, they would be compatible. Today we find that in biorhythms, compatibility. So we haven't learned anything new. In fact, we're becoming more and more specific and more practical in our understanding of our nature. The universal love is with us. But our specific personal relationships is necessary to have some guidance in it. You know, you can fool yourself in love and then end up hurting yourself more. And yet if you understand it and accept it, you can flow with it. And if you spell love backwards, you see where it's difficult to live it all the time. Because you're constantly evolving. You never have an overall love. You see, that's one of the things you begin to see in the spoken word, the very principle is locked up of the anguish and the frustration and the release. And then you look at the anatomy of the body and how it operates, then you can understand why the wise man says, be in the world, W-O-R-L-D, but not in the W-H-I-R-L of it. Don't be caught up in the movements of it, because you'll get sick, you'll get angry, you'll get frustrated, you'll get violent. So learn to accept the person as they are, and if they accept you as you are, in the end, the relationship grows. But if they can't accept them, they try to mold you, and you're trying to mold them, you end up doing what? Breaking up. And I don't have anybody molding anybody. We can only mold ourselves. And so, for that reason, the wise people and the realized people all tell us, pick up your cross and follow. Pick up your own ideas, pick up your own reality. Live your own life. And you will automatically attract people. And here's a good example. When you walk into this room, you look at the many chairs, and yet you ended up in one chair, which you felt what? Comfortable to be sitting around? That's what we're talking about. It is a sort of sensing the compatibility or the comfortness or the comfortableness of that location, of that spot. And that's the same whether you're relating to another person. How you feel, how you attract when you live. And if you're in doubt, go to sleep. You know right away, you can't carry on inside your head. You love to, but there's no way. Any other question? You had a question you were asking me of repeating a certain mantra. And what did it do? All mantras, whatever the phrase or the meaning of it, gains its momentum from the time it was started. And you can actually get some kind of transference because others have used it so long that it intones a unification with your mechanism. And it will help to arrive at a certain quality in yourself. But there's a handicap in repeating a mantra in a foreign language that you don't understand what it means. Even though you give it the best of your intention to repeat it identically and want to be part of those resonances, a part of you is fighting. There's a story that goes like this. They say there was a war going on between an asura and a deva. And the asura was repeating a mantra that the deva was repeating. And the both were repeating the same mantra, but the asura mispronounced one of the words and blew himself apart. So, what that is telling us is this. We get songs given to us, and we grow up and hear it. And it has done a great deal for many people born in that particular language structure, fine. Others come into it. somehow deep down, they're not getting the full benefit of it. It is because you have outgrown that particular level of understanding of the sonic in that part of language. Now, in Tibetan language, Om Mani Padmani Om, and it will go on louder and louder in yourself and over and over. For as far as some people born in this part of the world, Om Mani Padmani Om don't mean a single thing in their head. But they'll repeat it, because it seems to have some kind of intriguing pull on their mechanism. And they can lose themselves in it. And yet, deep down inside, something is holding back. What does it really mean? Why am I talking English? Now, it's hard to say I and the Father are one, because right away that creates conflict in English. And yet, Om Mani Padmani Om. If you translate it, may also be you and the Father are one. You see, but because it's a foreign language and it doesn't challenge any identity of ego in you, you will quickly relate and say. But when you get back to English, now, where the intimacy comes in, and not to be threatened with the fact that it's a foreign language and you may gravitate to it because it seems to have more of a heritage. The challenge and the contribution is in the present language structure you find yourself.